Welcome to Lecture 9 of the Introduction to C++ course. Today we're going to talk about bitmap files, bitwise operators, and RSA encryption at the request of Slavic. As always, if you have any questions, please feel free to ask them in the IRC channel, and I'm going to try my best to answer them on voice here. And if you have any comments or anything after the lecture, please post them on the boards. So, starting off for the next homework, you're going to be writing routines that load in a bitmap file. So on slide number 2, we're going to start delving into the structure of the BMP file that Windows is known for. If you open up Microsoft Paint, you can store images in the BMP format. And this is one of the most universal formats, at least in the Windows domain. So when we talk about a bitmap, there are mainly three parts. The bitmap file header, which begins the file. The bitmap info header, which tells us a little more about the bitmap that's being stored. And then finally, the uncompressed 24-bit data section of the file. And actually, bitmaps can be stored in lots of different ways. They don't have to be stored as uncompressed bitmaps, but they can also be stored in a method called run-length encoding, which is used to store GIF images and PCX images. The BMP can also not be 24-bit, but it can also be 32-bit or 8-bit. Or even 16-bit, but it just takes a lot of code to support all of those different formats. So for now, we're just going to concentrate on loading in a 24-bit uncompressed, or RGB, bitmap structure. So let's just take a look at each of these three components of the bitmap image, and we'll also take a look at the steps required to load in a bitmap image and then process it. So now we're on slide number 3, and we're going to go through steps for loading in the image. So first, we're going to load the two bitmap headers in. On slide number 2, there were two headers, the bitmap file header, which tells us a little bit about the bitmap file as a whole, and then secondly, the bitmap info header, which is just information about the bitmap, its width and height, and so on. So on slide number 3, after we load the two headers, then we're going to dynamically allocate enough memory to hold the bitmap, because when we load it in, we don't know how much memory we're initially going to need, because we don't know how large this bitmap image is going to be. So this is a perfect instance where we'll want to use dynamic allocation, as opposed to static allocation. If we did this statically, we'd have to guess at what the size of the bitmap would be. And in our games, we have small bitmaps and large bitmaps, and if we use the large bitmap, if we just assumed that if we just use the largest possible bitmap for every single bitmap, we'd use way too much memory. And then finally, we're going to load in the bitmap data. And in a bitmap file, it's usually reversed, oddly enough, and we're going to see how that occurs later on. And we're going to load that into the newly allocated memory. So this is in general how we load in any bitmap file, not necessarily .bmp, but also a .gif or a .jpeg, except in most of these, there's a 2.5 step, which is decode the data into raw form or uncompressed form. So on slide number 4, let's take a look at the header structure that is at the very top of our file. So right when I open up a file, then the very first thing that we're going to see is this BF type word. A word in this case is 16 bits, a double word is 32 bits. In this case, it's actually compiler dependent. But at the beginning of our file, the first two bytes are going to be the type of the file. And here in the slides, I've mentioned a few things about some of the parameters that are important. For instance, for BF type, a lot of different file formats will put a few characters at the very top. And this is used to identify the type of file in case the extension is lost. In Linux, for example, we don't have extensions, so one way to figure out what kind of file it would be to read in the first few characters from the top. And in this case, we can identify it as a bitmap if an MB is stored there. And I'm also putting up a link to Microsoft's website, which gives more detailed explanations for all of these variables. As far as I know, there was a question asked about an S word, a six-tuplet word, and I'm not sure about that. I've never heard of an S word before. All right, I guess it was a joke. So, we can take a look at this. I put it into a structure here, and this is how it's actually defined in WinGDI.h, which is part of the Windows SDK. So you actually don't have to put this structure at the top of your file. In fact, it's defined inside the Windows SDK, so if you pound include windows.h at the top of your file, then you can just use this bitmap file header. And last time we learned about structures and how many bytes they took up and everything, so we can just read in this entire thing, and I put some code down at the bottom of that slide there. So we can just define a structure called bitmap file header, bitmap header. So the structure is stored in the variable bitmap header. And after we open up our file and everything, and if the file variable is called infile or the file handle, then we can just call infile.read, and we're storing the data inside this character pointer to bitmap header, which we just declared as a type bitmap file header. And then this is a new operator, a new C++ reserved word that we haven't talked about called size of. If you ever want to know what the size of anything is in C++ or C, you can just use this size of command. And it's actually a reserved word inside the compiler. And it'll tell you the exact size of whatever's inside the parentheses. So if I put size of int, then it should return 4 for 4 bytes. If I put size of char, it should return 1 for a single byte. And in this case, size of bitmap file header, well, if we add it up here, then we have a word, we have three words and two double words. So 2, 4, 6, 6 bytes for the words, and then 8 bytes for the double words. And that makes 14 bytes total. However, there's one little thing that we need to be cautious about. In this case, the bitmap file header is 14 bytes. But our compiler is set by default, if you're using Microsoft Visual Studio, to make all structures to pad them at the end with additional bytes to round it off to the nearest 4-byte alignment. So if we have 14 bytes in this structure, then that isn't divisible by 4. So the compiler will automatically make that 16 bytes, padding the end of the structure with zeros. And this is bad in this case, because we're reading in from a file, and we don't want to read in 16 bytes of data. We only want to read in 14 bytes of data. So perhaps in your compiler options, to make this work perfectly, you would have to change the alignment of these structures to 4 bytes instead of 8 bytes. So that might be a really cool enhancement that you could do if you're getting errors. And chances are you will get an error, because you'll be one or two words off when you read in the next header if you keep the 8-byte alignment. So that is the header structure. Another important member of this header structure here is the BF off bits, which is the byte offset of the data from the beginning of the file. So there's a huge buffer inside the file, sort of a buffer, and this buffer is the uncompressed image data. And this uncompressed image data is stored somewhere in the file, but we're not sure where. So all we have to do is take a look at the BF off bits, and that'll tell us the offset from the beginning of the file to where the uncompressed data starts. So that's very useful to us, because we can use that file seek command to immediately go there and just start reading in data. So let's see what other goodies are in these header structures here. So on slide number 5, we have the bitmap info header. And this is what comes next in the file after the file header. So this I've pointed out 4 important parameters here: the width, the height, the bit count, and the compression. As you'd expect, the width and the height are the width and height of the image. The bit count is the number of bits per pixel in the image. And in this case, we're loading in 24-bit or 32-bit images. So you should make sure that that bit count is 24 or 32. And then for the BI compression, that should be BI underscore RGB for uncompressed red, green, blue. And again, if you want more information about this header structure, I'm going to post the link, or you can just go to MSDN, and they have a lot more information about all these parameters. But most of these are not going to be used in this case, because they are for palettes, or they're for other applications that don't deal with uncompressed images. So here I just put the link to the bitmap info header page, MSDN page, onto the IRC channel. And again, we're just going to read that in, and we can read it in from the current cursor position if we want to, because we just read in the first block, so our get cursor is right at the beginning of this info header block. And again, the bitmap info header structure is defined inside WinGDI.h, so if you pound include Windows.h at the top of your file, then you can just use this info header structure automatically, and it'll be there for you. So you don't have to re-declare it inside your code. So on slide number 6, let's talk a little bit about the BMP data. And it looks like this text is a little large here. So let's take a look at what this is. You got most of it there, though. So first of all, we have to realize that the bitmap data, the uncompressed data, begins at the BF off bits bytes from the beginning of the file. So we can just do a seek, and we can seek to that position in the file. Secondly, this makes it a little tricky. If we have 24 bits, this is actually the third bullet, if we have 24 bits, then each color is represented by 3 bytes. But if we're using a 32-bit display mode, then each color is represented by 4 bytes. So you might need some kind of conversion there to get it from 3 bytes to 4 bytes. And secondly, what makes it confusing is the second point, and that is that each row in the bitmap is padded with zeros, so that's a multiple of 4 bytes. So if we're using that bit count equals 24, then that's 3 bytes per pixel, and that doesn't necessarily equal a multiple of 4 bytes for every row. So in a bitmap file, we pad the end of each row so that each row is a multiple of 4 bytes. And this is, again, for efficiency reasons, because the 32-bit processor can most efficiently process multiples of 4 bytes. Last, to further complicate things, if the height of our file is positive, if the height of our image is positive, then the image's rows will be reversed. And I don't mean front to back, but top to bottom. So the first row in our image that we read in from the file will correspond to the last row in your image. So as you build up your image, you'll have to store things starting in the bottom row and storing them upward. Why they did that, I have no idea. But if your BI height is negative, then it's stored in the normal order. So make sure you accommodate for that. And that's pretty much all you have to know about bitmaps to start loading them in and trying them out. But of course, there's lots of information online about how to do this. And on slide number 7, there's a great, if you're interested in loading in like PCX files or GIF files or even JPEGs, which are pretty tough to load in because of the compression algorithm, you can go to WATSIT. And WATSIT is www.watsit.org, and you can find out anything about just about any format, file format. So if you want to load in 3DS files from 3D Studio Max or .x files from DirectX, you can go to whatsit.org and they probably have several files about it. So it's a pretty neat site. They're not always the easiest to read, but they definitely have all the technical data there. So now at Slavik's request on slide number 8, we're going to do some bitwise operators. So what are bitwise operators? They're operators that perform direct logic on individual bits. Maybe I should have taken out that second operators there. But they perform logic on individual bits. Normally when we do addition, we're thinking not at the bit level, but at the number level. So when we talk about bitwise operators, we're talking about basic Boolean logic, like and not and or. So we've already seen examples of these bitwise operators, the left and right bit shift operators in the second lecture. So on slide number 9, we can talk a little bit about bit shifts. So what's confusing is that a bit shift is the double left hand, or the double less than symbol, or the double right hand symbol. And these are also stream operators in C++. But it's easy not to get them confused, because when we're using these operators, it's usually a variable and another variable, or variable and a number. And the variable in this case is almost always unsigned. It's almost always a type that's recognized by the C++ compiler, and it's not overloaded. So, both operators will insert zeros if they shift it. They shift in zeros, and they'll shift out ones. Maybe that's what I should have written on there. So, for example, let's just do a quick one. If we set myvar equal to 34, and this is an unsigned character, these won't work quite as well on signed numbers because we use the most significant bit as the sign. But in this case, you can see the binary representation of 34 to the right. If we shift left these bits by 2, then all of the ones get shifted over by 2 positions. On the third line there, if we shift left by 3 instead of myvar, that's kind of, if you shift left by 3 and replace the second myvar by 3, then note that the rightmost one will be shifted over to the left 3 places, and the one on the left will disappear because it's shifted out. And in the final case, if you shift to the right by 3, then that one will be shifted 3 places to the right. So what's one application of bit shifts? So one of the tricks that game programmers used to use on slide number 10 is that the bit shift is an incredibly fast way to multiply or divide by powers of 2. And I've tried to represent this here. So we're using the same example as before, except I put the 3 there instead of my there. And this used to be that the processors were really slow in multiplying and dividing, but they were really fast in doing bit shifts. So you could do a bit shift in, for example, one processor cycle, while a multiply would take 10 times longer. So bit shifts were a really powerful tool. So again, let's take a look at this. We have a 34, and we shift it to the left by 2 places. Now we know that each digit is a power of 2, so 34 times 2 to the second power, and that 2 comes from the bit shift to the left, is equal to 136. And if we count up the ones there, they actually come to 136. In the third line, we shift again by 3. And in this case, our same tactic works again. 136 times 2 to the third power. The 3 comes from the 3 in the myvar shift. But this time we take the modulus by 256. And 256 are the total number of possible values we can store in 8 bits. And when we take this modulus, then we get 64. And if we count up, then that 1 is in the 64 position if we convert it to decimal. So this is a really simple formula you can use to when you're doing your bit shifts. You always have to take the modulus because the bit is shifted out of the 8-bit segment here. So the maximum possible value is going to be 255, and that's consistent with the modulus operator. In the fourth example, we're dividing by 2 to the third power. So 64 divided by 8 is 8. If you count it up there, 1, 2, 4, 8, then again that final number there is indeed 8. So that's a really neat way to talk about bit shifts. And this was actually used by game programmers for a long time because it isn't too hard to read, but it is a little confusing, and it's a lot faster. So it at least used to be. Nowadays the multiplication divides are, I mean, they're getting pretty fast. So the bit shift and the multiplication might even be somewhat equivalent nowadays. But some authors, like André Lamothe, still say that the bit shift is faster. And in fact, it probably is, if we look in the Intel manuals. I haven't done that, but they are available online, and you can see how many processor cycles a bit shift would take up rather than a multiply. So that's just a little bit about bit shifting and why it might be useful. So on slide number 11, let's take a look at some bitwise operators. Some more bitwise operators. So these are sort of Boolean logic, if you've ever heard of that before. Normally in Boolean logic, if you took a math course in it or a logic course in philosophy, Boolean logic would deal with true or false. And in this case, it's the same thing. A 0 is false and a 1 is true. So here we're applying it to bits, and we're using the same sort of logic. And applying Boolean logic to bits was actually a large achievement in circuit theory, because it enabled us to make digital circuits, digital logic. And it turns out that just with a few of these gates, is what they're called in digital circuitry, if you have a NAND gate, you can pretty much make any digital circuit, including one that adds numbers and subtracts numbers and multiplies numbers. These really are fascinating operators. And a NAND gate is a not AND, so it'll take the result of a NAND gate and invert it. But just to go through here and to kind of give you a flavor of what these are, for a NOT gate is very simple because it's just a unary operator, and it only operates on a single digit. So NOT 0 is equal to 1. So NOT false is equal to true. And NOT true is equal to false. It's very simple, a unary operator. If we take a look at the AND symbol, and in C, the AND is just a single ampersand as compared to the comparison operator, which is a double ampersand. AND you can think about as you need two things to be true for the result to be true. So something and something, both must be true. So 1 and 1 is 1. And they both have to be true. It has to be true and true. So you can say, one way that I think about it is, you can say two statements. For example, if I said, the sun is yellow and the sky is blue, is that true or false? The first one's true, the sun is yellow, and the second one is true, the sky is blue, although you could argue that's due to reflection from the ocean, I guess. And in total, the whole statement that I said was true. However, if I said the sun is yellow and the sky is brown, then my entire statement would be false, so I'd get a 0. If I said two false things, then my entire statement is false. If I say one false thing, then my entire statement is false, because I use that and to connect them. And if I say two true things, then my entire statement is true. And that's the only situation where my entire statement's true. So you can take a look at those numbers, and that's kind of where the and is derived from. And the same thing happens with or. So with or, I could say, well, either the sky is blue or the sun is yellow. And in that case, both would be true, so my statement would be true. And this is for or. I'm saying that either one is true or the other is true. So if they're both true, then obviously at least one of them is true. So I get a 1. So what if I said the sun is yellow or the sky is brown? Then my statement would be true, because I said either the sky is yellow or the sun is true. Or the sun is... I don't know what I'm saying. I'm saying either the sun is yellow, which is true, or the sky is brown, which is false. And my entire statement would be true. So I would get a 1 as a result. However, if both of my statements were false, then my total statement would be false. Hopefully this is a little making some sense. And then finally, the fourth one there is XOR, or exclusive OR. And this one is only true if one or the other, but not both, are true. And you can see the pattern there. If both are 0, then we get a 0. If both are 1, then we get a 0. But if either one of them, but not both, is 1, then we get a 1. So that's the exclusive OR. Hopefully that makes a little bit of sense. It should make sense on slide number 12, because here's some more complex examples. Let's look at the rightmost one first. We're negating, or we're doing the not, on this string of bits. So note that the 1 turns into 1s turn into 0s, and the 0s into 1s. And it's that simple. If we go to the leftmost, remember here that if the top one is 1 and the bottom one is 1, then we get a 1. In all other cases, we get a 0. So we're doing the top string and the bottom one. And in result, then we get a 0 and then a 1. And note, only the 1s occur when there are 2 1s above it. In all other cases, it's 0. In the second example, we're using the OR. The OR is only 0 when the 1s above it are 0. It's 1 in all other cases. So with my example here, you can see that it's only 0 when the 2 above it are 0. And the third, this one's a little more complicated, the exclusive OR. If the 2 bits above it are the same, then we get a 0. If the 2 bits above it are different, then we get a 1. And that's the exclusive OR. Hopefully you can see how those are derived. So let's take a quick look at one really cool application of these bitwise operators that's used in everyday coding. It's used in the Windows API. We even used it before in loading in files. So the question is, what if I have a function and I want to pack several flags, a flag is something that's either on or off, into a single variable? For instance, to send its parameters to a function. So I have a function and I have lots of different settings. Like, let's say I have a message box function and displays a message box on the screen. And I can have lots of options for a message box. I can have, like, what if the user wants an OK button, or what if they want an OK and a cancel? Or what if they want a yes and no instead of OK and cancel? Or what if they want yes, no, and cancel? Well, obviously you can only have one of those 4 at a time. But you know, there are other symbols. So what if I want a hand icon on my message box? Or what if I want a question icon or an exclamation icon? And then finally, what if when they start up the message box, I don't want that message box to have the focus? Anything but the message box. Well, if I was writing a function for this, each one of these 3 categories, the number of buttons, the icon, and the focus, could each be a separate variable passed in. But this is kind of inefficient, because now I have to pass three things into a function when I could only pass one. And so it would save a lot of time and a lot of, not a lot, but some memory, or stack space, I guess, if I packed all of these into one variable. Because I don't have that many, if you look on my screen here, and they'll all pack into 8 bits. So what I do is called bit masking. I define the message box OK to have a value of 1, and note that every single one here, every single pound define, is a power of 2. So in the topmost example, I have 1. Note the pattern of my bits. That should be evident enough. So let's say I OR some of these together. Remember, with an OR, the result is only 0 if both of the operands are 0. It's a 1 in all their cases. So let's say I OR MBOK or MB icon hand together. So we take a look at MBOK, and it's the rightmost bit. And then we look at MB icon hand, and it's the fourth bit in. So if I OR them together, the only situation where we have ones in the result just happened to be where those ones are in the original pound defines. So if I take a look at the result, 0001, 0001, amazingly, that's made up of MBOK, and it's also made up of MB icon hand. And it's clear to see that. Because of the method of which I constructed all these MB whatevers, I can construct this packed flag here that's a combination of MBOK and MB icon hand. So now I pass it to my function called MBParam. And what if I want to figure out, so does this guy want a message box? Well, let's say now that I AND the MBParam with MBOK. So if I AND it, that'll only give me a 1 if the two operands both have a 1 in the same position. So in this case, for MBOK, I'll get a 1 and 1 result. For MB icon hand, I'm actually not going to get a 1 like I wrote there, but I am going to get a positive value, and that was more what I was going for. So if you AND it with MBOK, you're going to get a positive value. If you AND it with MB icon hand, you're going to get a positive value. But if you AND it with something that isn't in the original parameter, like MB yes no, we're not going to get a positive value because there aren't going to be two ones that line up. So this is one method, a really cool method, that we can pack a lot of variables or a lot of flags into a single variable and pass it to a function. This is used in lots of programs. It's used in the Windows SDK, it's used in DirectX SDK, it's used in pretty much every library you can get your hands on, because there are lots of situations where you want to pass flags. And this MB underscore OK stuff, I took this example from an actual Windows SDK function called MessageBox, and it pops up a message box on the screen. If it was used in Quake, then they probably defined MBOK somewhere in their code. But this is how it works. This is the gist of it. So someone said that positive is true and negative is false. So if we do MBParam and MBOK, then we get a true value, and if we're doing an if statement, then that's true. So MBParam is defined at the top of the right column. It's MBOK or MB icon hand. Oh, I see. In my example, MBParam and MBOK is true. That's correct. It should be true, because we're testing to see whether that value is true. Positive isn't true, and negative isn't false. Yeah, that's correct. MB param and MB yes no is false, because the user, or the programmer, didn't select the MB yes no when he passed it to the function. However, positive is true and negative is false isn't correct. False is only when the value equals zero. It's true in all other cases. But in this case, we're kind of working with unsigned characters, so there isn't any negative. All right. So now let's move to slide number 14, and again, at Slavik's request, we're going to do some RSA cryptography. RSA stands for the name of three computer scientists, Rivest, Shamir, and Adelman. And these were three professors who discovered this technique of encryption. And RSA is a technique, and what everyone was looking for was something that was really easy to multiply together, which were two large prime numbers, but it's really difficult to factor the product back into the prime numbers. And that's what the strength of the RSA cryptography algorithm is. The strength is that we can easily multiply two prime numbers together, but it's really difficult to factor them. Then finally, there are, since the RSA algorithm has been discovered, there are other techniques other than factoring primes that have been discovered to be easy to initiate but hard to break back down. And one of these techniques is called elliptical curves, and you can check that out on RSA's website if you want to. So there are a few other techniques other than prime number factoring, such as elliptical curves, that you can use for safe cryptography. And the elliptical curves, some people say that it's even better than factoring, and it's even more secure, faster to perform, but I'm not sure about about that. Right, hard to decrypt. Easy to encode, but hard to decrypt if you don't have the right key. So on slide number 15, the whole deal with cryptography is that you start out with plain text, you put it into an algorithm, and that returns ciphertext to you. And the algorithm can require keys, or it can just do it automatically. And evidently, if you don't have keys, then you just have to know the algorithm that's required to decrypt it. So if you don't have a key, then you pretty much just have to know what the algorithm was to encode it, or what the algorithm needs to be to decrypt it. So, finally, we have public keys, and public keys are accessible by everyone, and these are used to encode the plain text. So anyone on the internet can encode a message that's only readable by one person, by one private key. And a private key is something that is required to decode plain text that is encrypted with a certain public key. So each individual person may have his own private key, and he might give everyone the public key. So everyone can encode messages that only he can read. And that's the whole idea behind the public and private key system. And there are also more complicated schemes involving more keys. If you want it to be more secure, then you can have lots of keys that are required to open it up, for instance. So on slide number 16, I'm just going to go through a simple example of RSA cryptography. We're just going to encrypt a simple string. Computer scientists usually use Alice and Bob as the two main protagonists in the story of describing the people who are trying to transmit the message to each other. And sometimes the computer scientists are going to add in some more cast of characters if there are more than two people who are receiving and sending the message. And then finally, computer scientists use Eve as the eavesdropper, who's trying to read or alter the plain text, because it might be the eavesdropper's motive just to alter the plain text so that the message isn't readable when it gets to destination. Or rather, to alter it to suit his needs, to misrepresent the information or something. So let's just go through a simple encryption using RSA. And RSA is actually one of the techniques that's used for security nowadays. So this is a pretty relevant example, because this is a pretty good algorithm that stood the test of time, and I mean, it's even used today. So on slide number 17, it's actually pretty simple too. So let's say that Alice wants to send a message to Bob. So first of all, if we think about this, Bob is the one that's going to be reading the message. So Bob needs a private key, and Alice needs a public key to encrypt it. So first of all, Bob is going to start making up the keys. So Bob's going to pick two prime numbers, and he's going to find their product, because it's easy to find the product. You just multiply them together. And in this case, Bob picks P equals 37 and Q equals 17, which are prime. Yes, they're prime. And then we find the product of those, and it's known that if we find the product of two prime numbers, then that result is only divisible by those two prime numbers. And that's one of the strengths of the algorithm. There are only two factors of PQ, the two original primes. And that's why they choose primes, because that guarantees that a certain number has two factors. So now Bob's going to hand over this product to Alice. So this is part of the public key. He's giving them the product of his two primes, but not what the two primes are. So Bob's also going to hand out a second number to Alice. And this number is chosen in the following way. He subtracts one from P, and then he subtracts one from Q, and he multiplies these two together. And then he's just going to send out a second number that doesn't have a common factor with this resulting number. And an easy way to do this is just to maybe pick another prime number. But make sure that minus 1 and minus 1 isn't a multiple of the prime number. Chances are it isn't, but it could be. So we should check just to make sure. We subtract 1 from each prime number, and the result will not be prime, because we're multiplying two odd numbers together, and that gives us an even number. And an even number is never prime. However, it might have... I guess it wouldn't have prime factors. But you should check just to make sure. But in this case, I'm picking a prime factor just for fun. Because if you divide 576 by 19, then you'll find that it isn't an even factor. And that's really all that matters. We're not sending this P minus 1 times Q minus 1 out. We're sending the E equals 19. And we just arbitrarily chose 19 because it isn't a factor of 576. So this is another part of our public key. So we also send that E equals 19 to Alice. So now Alice has the public key. The public key is PQ and E. So she got the numbers 629 and 19. So now Alice is going to use this public key to encrypt her message. So Alice's message in this case is ace. And this uses a really simple system. And we're just assuming that we're just going using the numbers from A through whatever 9 is, I suppose. It doesn't really matter. You can change your message into numbers any way that you want to, and this system will still work. And this is kind of a cheesy way, but it'll work for now. And so we just encoded ace as 135. And this is just an example, because in the end we're going to try to get the number 135 back instead of the letters. You can also use the familiar encoding that I put there, A equals 1, B equals 2, etc., for every single letter. Or you can even use ASCII. It doesn't really matter, just as long as you have some system of changing letters into numbers, if you're sending letters. If you're sending numbers, then there isn't a big problem. All right, So Alice is going to use this formula down here to translate this number into ciphertext. So the formula is m to the e mod pq. And if you'll remember, pq and e are the public key. So Alice just received these from Bob. She's going to put in pq, 629, and she's going to put in e to the equation, which is 19. And then the number she wants to send is 135. So it comes out being 50 if you perform that calculation. And as you're seeing right here, 135 to the 19th power is one huge number. So if you're using C, that won't fit in any of the standard variables. So you're going to have to use a big number library just to handle that. And if you want to try this stuff out, by the way, graphing calculators won't be able to handle these huge numbers either. So if you use the calculator that comes with Windows, if you just go start, run, and then type in calc, that one will be able to do large numbers like this. As for which data type you would use, you'd have to use a special library that can handle huge numbers. And that's one of the problems with factoring numbers. It just takes so long to do computations with huge numbers. So now let's go to slide number 19. So Alice just encrypted her message, and it's now a 50, and it was originally a 135. So Alice just encrypted her message, and she sends it to Bob. I should have mentioned that, but she sends it to Bob. So now Bob wants to calculate what the plain text of the message was. So this is just one way of doing it without going into much math or anything. But the fact is that Bob has the private key. The private key is P and Q. It's made up of two parts, too. He knows what the factors of that number are. So he can calculate P minus 1 times Q minus 1, which is 576, like we said earlier. And it ends up coming out to this equation up here. And you can find the derivations of this equation. It's actually pretty easy to derive. But it's available online if you want to know the mathematical details. For here, I just wrote the equation. But our goal here is to find some value x, so that this some integral value of x, so that this whole expression here equals an integer. So what I did was, on the second line there, I just plugged in some values, and I have x still there. So I'm just going to say, assume x equal 1, and I'm going to plug that in and see if that is a decimal, or if it's a whole number. If it's a decimal value, I'm going to try x equal 2. And if that's not a whole number, I'm going to try x equal 3. And finally, when x equals 3, it is a whole number, and it's equal to 91. Finally, once we get that d equals 91, we can finally plug it into this formula down here, which looks very much like the original formula. And again, there are derivations of all this online if you're really interested in the math. And it's actually not that bad, calculation-wise. So if I just plug that in, so we get 50 to the 91th power. 50 is the value I got from Alice. And 91 is that value I just found for D. And mod it by PQ, which is the public key, then I get the original plain text, which is 135. So we were asked how you split letters into 135, and in this case it's just an example. I just chose the number 135 just to show that we can get back 135. The main thing is that you just need a scheme for converting letters into numbers if you want to send a text message. Because if you have numbers, you know, you can break it down into smaller parts or whatever you want to do. The main thing is that you convert your letters to numbers in using some scheme. Might be any scheme. But you just need a stream of numbers to send to this algorithm. So that's the basics of RSA cryptography. So on slide number 20, again, Bob sent Alice the public key, which is PQ, and his number E. And then Bob retains the private key, which is necessary to decode the text. And the private key is the two primes. So Bob can send that public key to anyone, and they can use it to encode a message. And then Bob can easily decrypt that message, and no one else can. So Bob's the only one who knows what P minus 1 times Q minus 1 is. So the security of this algorithm relies on the fact that it's very difficult to factor that public key. Because what you're giving everyone is a multiplication of the two numbers in your private key. So if they can find what those two numbers are, then they know the public key too. So in reality, we used two-digit numbers. But in real life, you would use hundreds of digits. 128, 256, 512-bit encryption, so that it's much more difficult to factor. You could easily factor the number that I gave in like less than a second, so it's not very secure. But it is a good example, just so that we can use our calculators to compute it. And there is another issue. To use this algorithm, we need a secure method of exchanging all of these keys, and so that two parties who don't know each other can reliably exchange keys and communicate. And one of the most popular exchanges, and the original one, was the Diffie-Hellman key exchange. And the RSA and the Diffie-Hellman were both integral in starting up e-commerce as it's known today. So just for fun, you know, you can try encrypting some of your own numbers or writing your own encryption software. And so finally, since I won't be here Monday, I'm just going to post the homework sometime. All the homework's going to be is load in a bitmap file, you know, store it in some memory, and then display it to the screen. That's going to be the homework. So I don't know if I'll write function declarations or what, but that's going to be the gist of the homework. So whatever you write is probably fine. It's mainly a learning experience for you. So, you know, whatever's fun for you. And this is also the second to last assignment. The final lecture will be on Thursday instead of Monday, because I have something to do on Monday. And also, the last lecture will probably cover, unfortunately, I don't have time to do everything, so we're going to probably skip the sorting algorithms and try to do an entire lecture on a 3D ray casting engine, and perhaps that could be the last assignment. Although that is a bit of work, so I'm not sure how many people will get it done, but I'll release the solution and all, so it should be fun. And you can definitely do a ray casting engine with minimal 3D knowledge, since it's mainly 2D trigonometry. And so I think that's a pretty good happy medium, although trigonometry is still a little tricky. And you can also use the graphics libraries you've been building up, and I'll release solutions to everything, so you'll have the entire graphics library when you start on that assignment. So it should be pretty fun. Thanks for coming along to lecture number 9, and that's a wrap. I'll see you next week.